Well, first of all, I want to say I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak here. I have a few times over the years, and I always love it. This morning, I'm going to be talking about following your dreams, and I'm going to be standing up for dreams. And it may seem odd to be talking about dreams in this world with all the recent activities. But I still believe that as most of the people we read quotes from, that dreams make all the difference. And so I'm still standing up for them. And I'm also thinking a lot about traveling since it's the beginning of summer. And frequently I have traveled along with Alan to Tuscany. So my beginning begins with an experience I had in Tuscany. And I think it leads to this land of dreams, I hope. Anyway, I'm driving the Chianti Giana. It's the primary road through the Chianti wine country in Tuscany. Something like the road through the Napa Valley with vineyards and wineries on each side. It's narrow, one lane in each direction. And the traffic slows through each of a series of small towns and speeds up in between them. I'm on my way home this time from a successful, though nerve-wracking, journey. I found the place that Marco, my maestro di ballo, recommended for buying ballroom dance shoes. It's a hole in the wall, really, out by the airport in the fringes of Florence. So I'm feeling pretty pleased with myself for having the courage to set out on this completely unfamiliar territory and completely alone. So only after I'm skimming the Chianti Hills patterned with vineyards and olive groves does it come to me with an energy almost sexual. I relish this time alone. I crave it. I hear myself sing to myself an exultant almost hymn. My life is my own, all this. Suddenly, I stab for the brakes with my right foot, simultaneously stabbing for the clutch with my left foot to avoid stalling. A horse, a tall sorrel, is trotting down the highway with saddle, without rider. He's traveling the same direction as I'm going, but on my left in the opposing lane. He's heading into potential oncoming traffic. And then on my right is the rider running in the grass on the right-hand side. He's running after the horse. He's sort of a colorful young man. He had on a bright red shirt with a jaunty feather in his Robin Hood style hat. And so he's running and calling and running and calling, but his horse shows no sign of heeding. In fact, what was previously a trot has turned into a gallop as the prankster turns a piebald eye toward the panting owner. The young man is puffing and galloping himself and then slowing to a walk only to gallop again. Luckily, no oncoming traffic has made its appearance yet, but it can't be long before a feisty Pujo comes racing around the bend. The traffic in my lane, lane and accommodation has slowed to a snail's pace. Still moving faster, though, than the young man, though not as fast as the runaway mount, who has vanished now around a curve. I pass the young man. Clearly, he isn't going to catch his horse on foot. Heaving, he has been forced to a walk. Well, this is an extremely dangerous situation. The Italians don't seem to invest themselves in the plight of the horse or of this frantic young man. Cheeks red with exertion, black hair soaked with sweat, creeping out from under his feathered hat. And so, the shy straniera in me, with little command of the Italian language, taught never to give a strange man a ride in my own country, surprises herself. In my concern over the plight of the horse and the rider, I lose myself, my timid self, and a stronger self emerges, who without self-conscious forethought simply acts. I pull over and as the young man comes up alongside the car, I offer him a ride. He gladly accepts. Muy peligroso, I say, my ears of Spanish automatically clicking in. Yes, very dangerous, he concurs, knowing some English and some Spanish, as many Italians do. We round another bend, and there the horse is ahead, galloping toward his friends, the young man says. The horse goes to his friends, and after a pause, not sure I've understood, he offers in way of explanation, his friends, the other horses. Ahead also is the young man's friends, on horseback, apparently members of the same riding group, and one has hold of the bridle of the runaway horse. We drive up, and the young man jumps out in his excitement, barely able to say thank you. He grabs hold of the reins. So as I leave him behind, I can see him in the rearview mirror, one foot raised toward the stirrup, preparing to mount. Stepping into the unknown takes courage, a kind of courage I rarely muster here in the United States. In Italy, I'm challenged to call it forth again and again. It's a courage that sets me free, not only to dream, but to bring dreams into reality. So today I am talking about traveling, and I'm talking about dreaming, and how through traveling, two dreams of mine have interlocked in a magical way, dancing and Tuscany. I'm standing up for dreams and for the endeavor to pull what the land of dreams is made of through to the land of earth. It is a struggle, and it requires a hand of grace, a hand of grace to bring that dream, whatever that dream may be, into reality. So I want to tell you, in addition to this story of the young man, my story related to dreams, and I hope that by telling it to you, you might find affirmation for your own dreams and the desire to bring them into reality and the courage to try. So my first dream begins with that program some of you may have watched on TV that's been going on for a long time now, Dancing with the Stars, Dancing with the Stars. So a long time ago, Jane Seymour, who was the television's Dr. Quinn medicine woman, she was one of the first on Dancing with the Stars. And she says, I heard her say, talking about this experience, I always wanted to be a dancer. She said that she had always wanted to dance, and now in her 50s, she finally had a chance to try. It's never too late, she said. So my dream goes back to childhood when I was studying ballet. I wanted to be a ballerina like Maria Tallchief, who was a famous ballerina of that day. And a little later, I was inspired by old Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies. Anybody ever seen those? Yeah. I dreamed of ballroom dancing with a romantic partner. I quit ballet, however, when I was a teen to make room for boys. And I had let go of that dream of doing everything a man can do, but backward and in high heels, as Ginger is reputed to have, was reputed to be able to do. And I let go of all of that for, you know, all the good reasons. You can imagine them: marriage, divorce, career, all that serious stuff. I occasionally went out for social dancing, but generally speaking, dancing disappeared from my life entirely. My dream resurfaced in my early 40s when I, a fellow graduate student at Starr King, asked me to go along with her to a ballroom dance class, followed by a tea dance. She didn't feel comfortable going by herself. The teacher, a bit seedy, with unkempt hair and salt and pepper beard, greeted us and told us the class would be in American tango. So as the lesson got underway, he called on me, a beginner, to help him demonstrate the basic figures of American tango. So I was incredibly complimented and a bit scared, but I managed to follow him through the figures. My ballet training helped. Afterwards, he asked me if I had had tango lessons previously. And when I answered no, he seemed surprised and went on to say, I must be a natural dancer. Right then, that long buried seed showed signs of life that later developed into a full-fledged determination to realize my dancing dream, not knowing if I ever could sufficiently. And the second major dream goes like this. My passion for dancing coincides with the passion for Italy, and most particularly Tuscany, the second dream. On a Sunday afternoon, I was watching a travel show on PBS. The host was walking the Cinque Terre in Italy. Rick Steves, high above the Ligurian coast. The rugged path, the blue of the sea, and the astounding beauty of the five ancient towns interspersed along the way, rising up from the blue, just totally captivated me. I said to myself, I want to walk the Cinque Terre. The desire to walk the Cinque Terre grew into a determination to go to Italy, something that in the past I would simply have let slip by me, bracketed as unrealistic or too much trouble. Then less than a year later, I was spending several weeks in a small Tuscan town that no one has ever heard of in the United States and still hasn't, Brenna, on the River Merce, south of Siena. It was one of the most beautiful periods I've ever spent with my parents, whom I talked into going with me. I had rarely seen my mother so happy. She loved the place, the house, the terrace, the little town with only one street, a tiny cave of a grocery store, and a single tremendously popular pizzeria that served marvelous mussels and trout. And yes, I did see the Cinque Terre. I didn't have the hike I hoped for, but we three, my mother, father, and I, took a rocking boat ride from Lerici at the southernmost point along the coast to Monterosso, the northernmost town of the Cinque Terre. I learned I could do it. I could, with intention, fulfill a dream. Only 3 years later, my mother died suddenly of a massive bleed. The time I had with her and with my father in Tuscany turned out to be a very special gift, a fulfillment by the powers that be of a very special, beautiful dream. So I have always been a dreamer, but I haven't always had this courage of my convictions. I have another side, the stronger of the two for most of my life. It's an inner voice that says, you're selfish. It's a voice that society has largely adopted. A pragmatic voice that says, you have to compromise your dreams. A judgmental voice that says, hard work is what it's all about. A moral voice that says, think about others, not yourself. The prevalence and power of the accusing voice that says you're selfish was brought home to me by my students, a class of working adults who had enrolled in an interdisciplinary master's degree program at St. Mary's, and where I was teaching. The introductory course was called It's About Time. It's About Time. So I asked the students to introduce themselves by describing what time means to them or what their experience of time is like. In one group of 20 students, 17 of them, including every woman, used the word selfish in introducing themselves. They felt selfish taking time for themselves. And particularly in enrolling in a course of study which was oriented toward personal enrichment, not job enhancement. I feel really selfish because it's for me, they repeatedly said in one way or another. My mother might have been among this group of women, as I am. I've incorporated the voice that says, you're selfish, and I carry the indictment within me. Another voice, the voice sounds like my father. Jeannie, you have to compromise. When he was a young man with a wife and child, he felt he had to compromise his dream of being a fine artist in order to make a living. And so he focused on commercial art. Hence his admonition to me, you have to compromise. He returned to serious painting only after he retired at the age of 70. And no doubt there is truth in this message of compromise. It is certainly a voice that I have incorporated in which has informed much of my life. But I think we're too quick to compromise the values that make life worthwhile for the values of the marketplace. Again, my students have made clear to me how much this kind of compromise demoralizes them. Many of them were financially successful. They'd had access to the material goods they so much wanted. But in this course in which they read the autobiographies of persons who have made significant life choices that have impacted society, Mahatma Gandhi, Elie Wiesel, Dorothy Day, Helen Prejean, underlying longing often surfaces of what one might call a spiritual nature. By reading these people, this longing was was surfacing, and it seemed to be what I would think of as a spiritual nature. They often complained that they didn't have time for the things that matter. Family, leisure, nature, contemplation, the good society. They complained that despite the material acquisitions, they still didn't feel fulfilled and that they wanted something more. The more was often voiced as a desire to make a difference, to do something for the poor, to write creatively, or to smell the flowers. I believe this is a way of saying that they have compromised their hopes and dreams, and the course provided a context in which their hopes and dreams were reawakened. So I'm very glad that my father returned to painting, but I hope it doesn't take us some 50 years to begin to realize our dreams. The British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott, whose distinctive contribution to the understanding of human development is based on his work as a pediatrician, validates this dreamer side of me. In his work, Playing and Reality, now a classic work of reference, he examines what in a child's early development opens the way to what he calls creative living throughout life. He writes, this is a quotation, "It is creative apperception, more than anything else, that makes the individual feel that life is worth living. Contrasted with this," he says, "is a relationship to external reality, which is one of compliance." One of creativity versus one of compliance. The world and its details being recognized, but only as something to be fitted in with or demanding adaptation. That's the world of compliance. Compliance carries with it a sense of futility for the individual and is associated with the idea that nothing matters, that life is not worth living. In a tantalizing way, many individuals have experienced just enough of creative living to recognize it, and to recognize that for most of their time, they are living uncreatively, as if caught up in a creativity of someone else or of a machine. Close quote. The voices that say you're selfish, you have to compromise, are the interjected voices of compliance. The voices that say, listen to your dreams, follow your passions, you can make your dreams come true, are the voices of what Winnicott calls universal creativity. The creativity that belongs to just being alive. A creativity that belongs to all of us, he says. It enables us to experience life as satisfying and meaningful rather than bound by the laws of compliance to a life of dissatisfaction, pent-up anger, and loss of meaning. Creativity, he says, is a force over against the power of compliance. In a world as confusing and conflicting and frightening, I am standing up for dreams, for following your dreams, large or small, for the desire to realize your dreams, and for the courage to try. And I'm not alone. You know, take heart from Winnicott or Maslow or Hesse or Campbell or Roosevelt or even Oprah. It was hard for me to muster up the courage to travel, but through that traveling, my two dreams have intersected fortuitously, Tuscany and dancing. So less than a month after my first traveling, I found myself beginning to write these words which I'm sharing now, sitting in a stone farmhouse, used to be the house of the sheep, in a medieval borgo above Greve and Chianti, the setting sun turning the pine trees rust gold. And in Tuscany, I found my maestro di ballo, Marco, my master of dance, who has awakened in me the technique and the freedom to really dance the way I always imagined I could. So when our dream is slipping away and we're doing everything in our power to recapture it, how foolish we can look to the outside world. Take, for instance, that young man puffing on foot down the highway, seeing the distance between him and his horse grow. I don't know the real story behind the horse that almost got away, but I believe that young man was following his dream, much as I am, and much as we all are, a dream that almost got away. So be it.